Welcome to Blackter. Join me as I examine the best of Black artists in my quest to becoming one myself. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Blackter. I am your host, Gabe Moses. Last episode, we took a look at the groundbreaking career of director, writer, producer, and actor Spike Lee. At the end of that episode, you may remember hearing this.
Don't say that.
That was Vanessa Williams in the 2021 sequel to the horror film Candyman. The subject of today's episode originated the title role in the 1992 film, the one and only Mr. Tony Todd. I had the privilege of speaking with Tony for this very special interview episode. Throughout the episode, we talk about his early love for the arts in high school, his theatrical background, the world of horror, and of course, the evolution of Candyman. Special thanks to Tony Todd for taking time out of his busy schedule to speak with me. So, without further ado, let's get into it. Candyman.
Hey, Candyman. All right, everybody, gather around. The Candyman is here. Now, what kind of candy you want? Sweet chocolate, chocolate malt, candy, gumdrops, anything you want. You've come to the right man because I'm the Candy Man.
Ooh. Who can take a sunrise?
Who can take a sunrise?
Sprinkle it with you.
Sprinkle it with you.
Cover it with chocolate and a miracle or two. The Candy Man.
The Candy Man.
Ooh, the Candy Man can.
The Candy Man can.
The Candy Man can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
Makes the world taste good.
I am here with Mr. Tony Todd. How's it going, Tony?
Hey, what's happening, man? How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Minute since we were in Central Valley.
It's been quite a minute, you know. Obviously, you know, you've had a great career in acting and all the mediums, television, film, and theater. But before we kind of deep dive into all of that, can you take me back to the very beginning for you? When was the first time you decided you wanted to become an actor and dedicate your life to this art form?
That answer is pretty easy for me. It was in high school, a growth spurt between sophomore and junior year, like 8 inches. And as much as I loved basketball, I was totally useless to the athletic department. I was literally walking down the hallway, tripping on everything. And, you know, on my quest to present myself, there was a English teacher, Mrs. Reynolds. I remember she gave me a copy of The Tempest. And I was a comic book kid at the time. And I remember reading it. It was like the pages were on fire. They were coming to life right in front of me. And then I got involved in high school dramatics and took it seriously. I said, this is my path. You know, that moment when you go on stage and your peers all of a sudden look at you in a new way and you realize you have the infinite ability to become other people and yet at the same time explore who you are. It was like a window opened up. So I stuck with it, got scholarships to UConn, but I dropped out of UConn. And finally I went to the Gene O'Neill Theater Center on a full scholarship, which led to Trinity Rep, where I got my master's.
Nice, nice. That's amazing. It's very, you know, a natural story for you.
Yeah, you know, this is in the mid-70s, and there was more concentration on government art programs and stuff, National Endowment of the Arts. I taught for a while in my hometown of Hartford, Connecticut, under an existing grant. I mean, there was more access to street theater. It was happening everywhere. You know, nobody was getting paid for it, but we found a way to express ourselves and work in the trenches. You know, billion spaces is theatrical canvases.
Sure. So,
yeah, it was a great journey of education first. It's been a good 10 years just training, studying, reading, watching everything I could.
Sure, yeah. In the midst of all that, you know, in these different educational environments, what did you come across any experiences being a Black man where you thought like, oh, okay, like this is how I'm going to have to kind of approach the art form because I am a Black man?
Well, you know, this is early on, so I found myself to be the only Black man in each one of these programs, right? But I was also surrounded by the Black Panther movement, particularly in my home state of Connecticut, the New Haven chapter, Black Panther, the Hartford chapter. And I was a spectator through that, kind of like, well, similar, akin to Ali and the Nation of Muslim, but I was just fascinated with their structure and their breakfast programs and stuff. So even though, you know, the higher, the classical theater training wanted me to study the classics, Miss Julie, Chekhov, Shakespeare, Ibsen, mm-hmm. But I knew deep down that ultimately I was going to be hired as a Black man. And this is before Wilson's. I didn't even have that to call on. But we found a way. There was a lot of, you know, Hansberry, you know, Baraka. We had our stuff that we could go to. And I would force my white classmates to read with me. And then I discovered Fugard, which opened up, you know, and, you know, I ultimately got to be on stage with him, so that was a full circle. You know, he was one of my teachers, and then 20 years later, I spent 3 years with him doing Captain's Tiger at the Kennedy Center. So, you know, I fully believe that you get what you put in, you know, and if you give back to your community and you tell your relatives and your parents why it is, what you is, what it is you're doing, and why you're drawn to it, ultimately they have to listen to you and understand you.
What is it about theater? So as someone who has been in front of the camera, you know, later in your career, more so than on stage, what is it about theater that excites you and that keeps bringing you back?
It's purity. It's ability to be in front of people without a safety net. You know, film and TV, there's all kinds of ways to disguise mistakes and so forth and get that right tape. Theater is pure. It's organic, it's live, it's refreshing, and nothing fills an artist's soul. Yeah, you can get a lot of money doing a TV series, you can make money doing film, and I'm telling you, and I know you know this, because I know they herald you, but there's nothing like the satisfaction of being on stage, whether they approve of you or not. As a matter of fact, I prefer it when they don't approve of you, when you force them, when you're forced to make them understand your unique position. So theater, you know, there's an old adage, movies buy the house, TV buys the furniture, the theater feeds the soul.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
And I, you know, someone who's done theater all of my life at this point, you know, I can already kind of sense that, you know, it's something that is really special, like having a live audience there experiencing the story with you.
Yeah.
You know,
at that moment. Whether it's a sudden rainstorm, like you guys came right through, or right, whether the lights go out, as we all went through, you know, yeah, it's electric, and it is something that will never, yeah, they can record some theatrical performances, but there's nothing like being in there that night at 8 o'clock on whatever year, and something magical happened.
Yeah, so, it's like everyone comes together. You know,
yes, it's a community, it's a commune, which is where it all started, which is where Shakespeare started with his rolling shows and stuff. It's necessary. And it's my greatest disappointment though with the structure of regional theaters and this company is that it excludes our communities. Okay. And I fight every time I do a regional theater, particularly during the August Wilson Cannons, okay? You look out, see out of a 500 seat theater, 480 white people, which is fine, they're entitled to go. But those plays are written for us. And always, usually they have some sort of pay as you can Tuesday, but ultimately that publicity doesn't get to the community. And it's some retired doctor that says, Marge, let's pay $5 a piece and go see some Negroes in the backyard. Right. So that part, I'm politically active in trying to change and make sure because now more than ever, I think our community needs to see stories that are about us that aren't on Live PD or Verse 48 or any other such nonsense.
You brought up August Wilson, and I kind of want to talk a little further about him. You were the original King Headley and King Headley II, and you also recently did a one-man performance of How I Learned What I Learned at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival. So the greatest playwright, I think, in my opinion, of all time, August Wilson, like, what about his work, like, what is so great about being able to tackle it, especially, you know, early on in your career versus coming back to it now?
August writes for a community of people, which happens to include me and you. And it's like, you know, I had colorful uncles growing up, and every time I look at August Wilson's play, it's like I'm eavesdropping on their conversation, no matter how intimate or challenged or, you know, August's words, the intentions are all in the words, right? So you don't have to really search for who am I, what do I want, what am I doing now? If you just listen to the stories and listen to the punctuations and stuff, the stories sing automatically. And I think that was his gift. Plus he had an innate ear, and the fact that he was a mixed kid to begin with, growing up, sitting at the laps of his elders and his communities and paying attention to each and every word and elevating their causes, right? Some people say, oh, there's no plot in August Wilson's play. But if you're Black and if you grew up in that community and you went to church and you saw the drama of people trying to play the numbers every day, you know, wishing for that dream, then you know what the drama is. And that's why I want more of us to experience not only Wilson, but other great playwrights who are emerging that speak to our particular need set.
And you met August Wilson, you got to work with him, right?
Yeah, 3 years I spent with him. Him, you know, he's an interesting man. He didn't have much to say. You know, he said it was all on the script, and he was very particular about his words. You know, mm-hmm. Notes you would get, oh, you left out this "and" that was in the second paragraph of that I wrote. He'd always be sitting in rehearsals with his hands behind his head, never watching, just listening. And he used to threw me off, right? Because we also had Max Davis, Max Roach, I'm sorry, the great jazz drummer who was our musical guy. He was completely opposite. He was listening, watching rehearsal, jibbing and jabbing, you know, going, yeah. So between the mix, you had the satisfaction that we all need during a rehearsal. But August is a peculiar cat. You know, he knew he was a genius. He knew he was important.
Yeah, definitely. What is it like now seeing his plays, you know, being transformed into films and for the camera and like being reached out for bigger audiences to see?
Well, I guess that's certainly important. But I remember him saying once that he never wanted his plays turned into films. Mm. I remember him adamantly saying that. And it's for this theater. There's something holy, as you know, about the theater. You know, mm-hmm. It starts with a blank space, and even when the tech goes and does their dream and then magically it transforms and it's complete, it's a church, man. And and it's something that TV and film doesn't provide in terms of that. It's like you can pause. August's work is not meant to be paused. You know, it's meant to be taken in its entirety. But anyway, the estate, Constanza Romero, I know her. She's doing well by it. I know Denzel has bought up the entire property. Yeah. The Two Trains Running is going to be filmed next with his son. Mm. So, you know, better it gets out there, I guess, than not.
And it's in good hands, at the least, you know, it's being done well, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
We'll argue about certain casting choices, but you know, another thing about August, he says, you know, and he actually said, at first I thought it was kind of cruel. He says, you know, I don't really give a damn about actors. Okay. He says,
yeah,
a shit will make an actor shine.
As opposed
to the other way around.
He was right. He was right about that.
Yeah, I argue with that because I don't know a black actor alive that doesn't dream of chewing up some of those monologues. I mean, chew it up in a good way. Not in a bad
Absolutely.
Way.
Yeah. And like, he was like my first introduction to acting. I mean, I auditioned. So I went to a performing arts high school and I auditioned with Corey from Fences. Like, so like, that was like the first play I ever read by a black man, you know? So in that way, it was like, that was my way in. So to see the history of it and to see where it is now, it's great to see that it's still living, you know, in the American theater.
That's great. Yeah. So, you know, the rumor about PSF doing Fences has been on their book for a while.
Quite a while. Quite a while. Maybe next year. We'll see. Maybe
yeah, he'll be back. I know I talked to Chris just last week. I know he's not available.
Yeah. So
for me, it all depends on who they get to replace him.
Well, we can only hope.
Yeah, and I hope if it is done, you know, it's this eight character piece. I hope that we have sufficient rehearsal time.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Cool. So let's move on to talking about the Candyman, of course. I want to first talk about the OG 1992 Candyman. Did you know it would be as successful as it was early on before the film even came out?
When I read the script, you know, a lot of people, your career is a luck of the draw. You know, I've done some successful horror films, I've done independent films, I've done some blockbuster films, but I'm not, people try to, Hollywood in particular tries to pigeonhole you. A friend of mine, Stan Shaw, another great actor, he says, Tony, you know, if Hollywood sees you as blue, they're gonna want you to play blue as long as that blue doesn't fade, okay? And no matter if you scream and kick, say, I want to tie yellow, I want to tie green, I want to be red, I want to be velvet, they resist. I've been fortunate because whenever I get bored, I go back to my first love, which is theater, and I reset, and I get them to change their mind, I come back. When I read the Candyman script, it wasn't like I wanted to do a horror film, but I had done a film in Africa called The Last Elephant, and the director, Bernard Rose, saw it and said, that's the guy. And I read it and I said, okay, this is like, this isn't your common Jason or Freddy or Michael. They're not like just aimlessly running and chasing down people. This is a man that has a clear purpose. He was lynched. He has a reason for being a ghost, a vengeful ghost. And this is who he is, no apologies. And I knew when I read the scene about the bees being in his mouth and stuff, I said, that's never been done in a film before. And it probably won't be ever done again. And I said, that's the key to this guy. You know, he's fearless and he's haunting and he's romantic and he's sexy and he's vengeful. And so we got together and we did that. We laid it down. And I'm gonna tell you, man, actors make money however they can. You know, before I made it, quote unquote, before I got my first film, which was Platoon, I was a bartender in New York, but at a theater bar, West Bank Theater Bar. So Lewis Black was my co-host. James Gandolfini from The Sopranos used to come in as a customer all the time and always complain to me, Tony, oh, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I got another rejection. Oh shit. I said, James, I ain't got no crystal ball, but hang there. You have a unique type. And lo and behold, what happens? It's the role of his life. So is Candyman the role of my life? I don't know. In some circles, for the horror fans, they love it. Whenever I get too bored, I can always go to a convention. I can sign pictures for like 6 hours at a time. But I wonder, is this the path of an actor? Or is it just another auxiliary benefit of being an actor?
In terms of filming it, you know, how was it different? You say the kind of horror story that it is has never been told before. How was it different on set versus films you had done prior to Candyman?
There was a reverence. I walked around. I always wore my coat on set, whether I was filming or not, because I wanted people to look at me in a certain way. And Virginia Madsen, the female lead, her and I, we did some of the, we went horseback riding together. We had fencing lessons together. We did ballroom dancing because we wanted to capture the elegance of a certain style. So that was fun. Burnett was fine. Clive was on set just smiling because he was making money. I was probably the lowest paid person on set, actually. I didn't make money into the second one. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
signing pictures. But I honor at this time, I was fresh out of acting school, right? So I was doing things like memory books and, you know, coming up with colors, and making sure my intentions are right. And at a certain point, you process that, but you learn to throw it away. Okay, interesting. So one of the first gigs I had was a soap opera. It was called Loving. And it only lasted 3 days because I was literally right out of school. And I went on the set and I asked the director, who am I? And what do I want? And where am I coming from? And, you know, what do you think about this? They wrote me out within 3 days. And I learned then, never ask them. You don't need to ask them. You know. If you're hired, they hired you, the essence of you, and you know what you're doing and what you're about. But being fired from that was a very important lesson for me. I said, okay, let's see how they roll.
Sure. Would you say that made you more confident as an actor and more prepared coming in?
It made me answer my own questions. You know, in theater, you have that time usually. It's not like PSF, you know, where we have 10 days, you know, normal sense. You got 4 weeks, right? And so you can answer those kind of questions, particularly with a new piece of work. And in the real world, in the film TV world, they hire you because you capture who it is, and you better show up on set, know your lines, and be ready to go moment to moment.
We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode. You mentioned the bees earlier. I want to know more about that, because I know there's a whole story about the whole bee scene. So please tell it.
Well, we had a real, we had a bee wrangler on the set. His name was Norman Gary. He was a very particular, peculiar man because he loved bees the same way me and you might love jelly on our toast, okay? This guy had him known by name. He said, Tony, it's time to meet the co-stars. They were living in the trailer. And I said, I'm playing along. He said, he started naming them. This is little Larry. And as later, sometimes he has an upset stomach. And that's Charlie up there. He likes the licensing, dude. Okay, whatever, I gotta do it. And literally, you know, all the scenes in the first movie, like we had that chest dam, we had to pour them in literally by a vacuum cleaner thing. In my mouth, I had a dental jam so that they could be poured in and it wouldn't go down my throat. Anytime you see me with the bees, they're real, 100%. They'll never happen again. And I just got used to them. And I had a good lawyer at the time, and we worked it out. For every sting, I get $1,000. That's an absolutely true urban myth. And I think I got 7 stings over 3 films.
How many?
There's 27.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm an honest person. I don't need to lie
about that. I know. Because, you know, online you see different stuff. So it's nice to get the real truth.
I'm sure online there's a million bees. I'm sure they kill naturally. I'm not even here. I'm just a ghost. I'm
right.
A ghost in the house.
Tony Todd real? Candyman?
It's, you know, I used to do some gang intervention work. And it allowed me, because everybody black certainly has seen this movie, okay? And more white people than want to admit. But it allowed the dialogue to occur because he has a certain fascination. It's a certain, particularly among gang life, it's a certain, justification. He's kind of a hero, you know? And I think what Mia's done in the new film is further emphasize that, but the fact that Candyman isn't just one person, you know, he's symptomatic of every disenfranchised victim, George Floyd.
Yeah.
in our community.
Never ends. Yeah, sadly. Yeah. You know? What is it about horror that you think has stuck with you throughout your career? You know, you talked about being the same types of roles, doing the same types of genres for a long amount of time. But what is it about you and horror that works?
Well, again, it goes to my friend Stan Shaw. Horror is my blue. And so you just see that we get sent scripts all the time. We reject 7 out of 10 of them because it's just badly written or they're just derivative or just people that don't understand. Until someone like Jordan Peele came along, who kind of reinvigorated the franchise and also reclaimed it for us. Because before that, and before the characters I've done, if you had a Black person in a horror film, you knew they were gonna die within the first 10 minutes, right? The best friend of the best friend, or the girlfriend of the girlfriend of the best friend, you know? And he came along and said, wait a minute, we have a right to be scared too. And there are horrific things that have happened to us that don't need to be made up. Right. And
yeah.
It was a success of Get Out. And so he's got his finger on it. Because of that, it's we've now got, I don't know if you saw the documentary Horror Noir.
No.
Okay, it's Tananu Reeve. She's a film professor at UCLA. She created this whole documentary on the history of Blacks and horror, all the way from Blackula, you know, from Birth of a Nation, which is probably the first horror film about us.
Right.
Perpetrators.
Yeah.
And this new miniseries that I'm a part of that comes out in October. But, you know, she's good friends with Jordan. So they're two new voices. Nia, of course, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a strong rumor that she may be nominated. So that'd be historic.
I believe it. So, you know, we're starting to talk about the new Candyman now, you know. I saw the first day it came out, you know, I was that excited. I know the movie was in the making for a while and of course was supposed to be, you know, premiered before COVID. But what was it like and what is it like seeing the progression of horror through this film, particularly, you know, versus the 1992 version? And, you know, with writers like you talked about, Jordan Peele and directors like Nia DaCosta, how have artists of today, specifically these Black and brown bodies and voices, change this genre of horror?
Well, I think you're going to see more evidence of it upcoming. You know, we exist with a particular thread of pain, you know, that's just a given of our DNA. Anybody that grew up with a grandmother or an uncle or a lost soldier knows what I'm talking about, right? There's that thread of pain, which is what makes us so terrific actors. If you go back through the history of Paul Robeson, Canada Lee, goes on and on. Even Sidney, even though he was, you know, selected, but James Edwards, who was actually chosen to be what Sidney became, but because of his involvement with certain white actresses in the 1960s, he was blacklisted. But if you study his films from The Killing to Dr. Strangelove, you'll see he was selected. One day I want to do a story about him. But we have a particular DNA, and America knows it. America tries to ignore it. At the same time, it copies, tries to copy our DNA. Suburban kids loving rap. I don't want to get too specifically racial, but the love of our Southern cooking.
Yeah, yeah.
Uncle Ben on the box of the rice. But it's a particular DNA that cannot be duplicated. Mm-hmm. And with, Michael K. Williams.
Yeah,
last week ago. Okay,
yeah.
It's an example of the DNA I'm talking about. How can I say this? Yes, you can be hungry if you grow up in a rich environment, you can find it. I've known some actors who but it's something you gotta have some disappointment. You gotta have your ears so that you can at least hear the pain of others, right? Of others' mothers and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that I know, because I'm doing some speaking engagements, there is more roles now for people of color than ever before in the world of Hollywood that I've seen it. When I started, Platoon opened, everybody that was in it was told to move out here, and I was lucky to ride that way. But now there's at least, you click on Prime, you click on Netflix, there's all kinds of roles. Now, are they all strong roles? Unfortunately, no, but they exist. So there's no reason for any young artist to be afraid of stepping into the arena at this point in life.
Yeah.
And bringing whatever it is that makes you, you, into the pie.
Yeah, you brought up Michael K. Williams, and just like thinking about his story and like seeing how a lot of people, white people, were almost like surprised about like his death and what he was going through in terms of like someone like him, that kind of actor or at his status couldn't have gone through that. But as a black person, and that's like kind of a root in that story, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's obviously going through a lot of demons, which made his work so electrifying. But it, you know, unfortunately, he chose the path of nullifying the pain that's not healthy. And God rest his soul. But in terms of an actor, I mean, he was brilliant.
Yeah. You know,
Fire is arguably one of the best TV shows ever.
Yes.
And I'm the stupid person that turned it down.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Three times?
Three times, because at the time, it was before it aired, and they wanted people to pay their own relocation to Baltimore and shit. And I was at the moment, but that was my bad. It wasn't the first mistake I made.
I'm sure you have more of those.
Yeah, but it's okay.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's been because once I'm committed to a piece, a lot of people, you know, they say, oh, come over here. No, you know, like I was working with Athol Fugard, and it was a 3-year commitment, and we kept getting calls by Quentin Tarantino for Pulp Fiction. And I said, no.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, it's okay. And then one more, I was doing a Western in Calgary with Christopher Reeve. It was based on a true story about the first black federal marshal in this country called Black Fox. And they kept calling about the Green Mile, and I like didn't leave that. So you know what, it's all good.
Hey, you know, it's all out, it's all done.
Yes, and then everything, it happens how it happens. At the same time, exactly. I didn't tell you the roles I wanted that I didn't get, but that everybody's got that. And that's what makes us unique.
Right, right. And it's all meant to be too.
Meant to be, and you roll with the punches. You never go, a great actor, Rita Moreno told me, you never get too high and you never get too low, okay? And a great acting teacher once told me, when you're going up a role you really want, that you know that you can do, you make a list of 10 reasons why you don't want the damn thing, okay? That way it helps you balance it out.
That's good. I'm gonna steal that.
Okay.
Yeah. What is it like seeing, you know, these young black actors in this time, especially the actors that are in this new remake of Candyman, kind of take on this new version of the story?
I think it's exciting. I'm not, you know, technically, since my character's a ghost, I mean, and I made the film 30 years ago, obviously it had to go younger, so I had no problem with that. And they found a way to incorporate me, and it's at the end, which if it's successful means that we're gonna do more. I've learned as an actor, I used to be extremely competitive audition-wise. I mean, I was the type of dude, if I knew you, I'd say, hey, what's up? But there was no lingering conversations. And if I didn't know you, I was gonna do my best to annihilate you. Okay, I'd be in my corner doing my, you know, vocal exercises and pacing, and like not deliberately doing it, but looking back, I realized it's kind of like a boxer, you know. I'm fucking doing you, so you see me, I'm going in next.
Right.
You better worry about what the fuck you're doing.
Right. Watch out
about what I'm doing in the room, right? But as I've gotten older, I'm more chill about it. I'm more more interested, I understand more is about the best person at that time in that moment that brings joy, you know, because it really is truly moment to moment. You know, you accept that, and the more you older you get, you learn that more and more what that truly is, and then you just be it. Yeah, so yeah. I love this new community, because when I was on this shit, other than Platoon, which had like five of us in it, but I would show up for gigs and I'd be the only black person on set, both in the cast and on the crew, which always upset me, because some of these crew positions, they're doing nothing more than pulling a cable and plugging it in. I never understood why there weren't more. Yeah. Fortunately, down since Atlanta's become one of the third film capitals of the world, it's so wonderful to see a whole black transportation crew, or black catering crew, or a black a black assistant camera, a black focus puller. You know, that way, because when it, I'm not suggesting separatism by no means, but I want people to understand when it's a black focus puller and a black DP looking through the lens, looking at you, and he knows what to look for, there's a difference.
Yeah, because you know it. You just know each other. You know
how to light each other.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and same for theater as well, you know, with people behind the scenes, lighting designers, costume designers, hair and makeup, like all that stuff. Like, just like inviting us into the room automatically makes that experience better for us, you know?
I was very interested in listening to the diversity challenges at PSF, particularly that one that we had, because I had never really thought of it or come across it, because I consider myself an old wolf, right? But it was interesting hearing people's positions, and a couple of things I objected to, like wondering if you're hired, wondering whether or not they're hiring you just because of you. I just no reason for that. I mean, if you get a job, just go for it, kill it, you know, kill it, and then earn your position in the room. And also, I think I'm worried about some actors feeling fearful before they even give it a try. There's no room for fear in the audition process. You have to clear your mind. Mm-hmm. You have to trust the material, and you have to go in there not to please the director or anybody else in the room, to please yourself.
Yeah, and they can see it too. They can see it. They can smell it. They sense it. You know,
what they need to walk out sensing is not your fear, but your hunger. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The right to be hungry. Definitely. I love that.
Yes. The phrase starving artist is on purpose.
There's a great generation of starving artists that made it, from De Niro, Gazelle, John Voight, Dustin Hoffman, at the same time, and they all were hungry as hell. And they all auditioned for the roles that made each one of them famous.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
Your role. Yes.
We kind of talked about this, you know, throughout the interview, of like the differences of how it was, you know, when you first started in the industry versus how it is now. But what's the biggest thing for you in terms of like, wow, I never expected to see this either in theater, television, and or film?
I never expected to see such a proliferation of black writers right now, particularly because Golden Dozen. In terms of staying power, we shall see. I've gotten to meet and work with a couple of them. That's important. I think what's missing, I think we need more black theaters, you know? I mean, we still have, there's one in Milwaukee, what's it called? Mixed Blood Theater. And you got Black Repertory Theater in St. Louis. You got Penumbra in Milwaukee. You got the Boston Black Shakespeare Project. But we need more. We need more. Yeah. And we need to figure out a way to get people that need to see the plays into the theater.
Inviting, for me, especially now, going off of that, is like inviting more Black audiences to the theater. You know, Shakespeare in the Park in New York just did two Black theater nights for their Merry Wives of Windsor. And just like having that accessibility is really important, especially now, I think.
Hmm. Did you go see that?
Oh, I did. I definitely did. Yeah.
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 Was it well received? It worked.
It was wonderful. Yeah. The adaptation was brilliant. And like the Black joy on stage was like beyond imaginable, you know?
Wow. That was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is next for you? Like what are the next steps? It looks like you have like a few films coming out soon. So what's on the border?
Well, you know, I've been working hard at this voiceover thing, and I finally cracked the whole the gaming system. So yeah. It took a long time. It's one of the toughest fucking mediums because everybody wants to do it because you can do it from home. And,
right.
But you know, I just got booked to do Venom, the Spider-Man game, Spider-Man 2 with Miles Morales and Spidey. And that's awesome. That's a big pop culture gig.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, I got like 6 films in the can and they're all well chosen and completely different. And, more video games.
I'm
excited.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Spider-Man in particular won't be out until 23. So stay healthy, alive, and kicking. I can't wait to play it.
Yes, we'll be on the lookout. You know, just to be working, you know, for your whole career and I mean, not really having a lot of downtime in those moments too. Just like, you think that you've ever, was there ever a moment where you got tired of it?
No, I love it that much. And this love comes from what that spark I felt in high school, back when it, I don't want to just casually say saved my life, but it did, because I was a social outcast. I was shy. I was uncoordinated. I couldn't mouth a sentence together. And theater gave me all that. It gave me a way to communicate. It gave me a way to say, hey, not only am I Black, but I'm a Black American, and I have something to offer, and I have a skill set that I've been trained, and I can eloquently present it to you so that you walk away. Like, one of the most important things about how I learned what I learned, because I didn't know going in, because it was a Catholic university, you know, right away I demolished Catholicism and shit.
Right.
You're not, but to a point, the ending of every evening was a celebration. And a small way, I know at least some of the thoughts that August was concerned about, the injustices, the casual impoliteness, racism, I think came across. And not only that, the man's capacity for love and humanity, you know?
Yeah.
I want more moments like that. I can't, now that Broadway is somewhat back, I told my people, find me a play, so we'll see.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Oh yeah, a new play.
Yeah, yeah. What has been one of your greatest achievements, you know, throughout your career? And with that, how has it kept you going?
My two children. My son and my daughter, Alexander and Ariana, my daughter in particular has gone to Wesleyan and Columbia and has very little debt based on that is no grandchildren yet, but that's, you know, and being in order for them to be raised, you know, there was a lot of moments of me not being around. If you see the current Ali documentary, which is brilliant, by the way. You know, he talks about his two youngest twins. He wasn't around, but he would come and tell them, you know, I'm the greatest, you know, I'm the greatest. And, you know, we do what we can as artists. This is a peculiar set. All you got to do is look at the history of jazz and how, and the Green Book, and how these guys had to play, man, in front of white audiences, and then go around the back to get a chicken sandwich and get on the bus and go to some raggedy hotel that was only for them, you know, but they, every night they came out and they played their music, which is what we do, because we are an instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Keep it in tune.
Right. All the time.
And then in the moments of inactivity, I just go back to remembering my conversations with James Gandolfini. You never know. You don't know when you got to be ready. You don't know when it's going to come calling, but you got to just be ready and you got to treat yourself right. You know, keep alcohol use to a minimum, try to stay away from hard drugs, and treat yourself like a temple.
I'm going to note all of that.
You know, we all make mistakes, but just, and having God, I know whatever religion that is for you.
Yeah.
You know, when you grew up Black, so I can probably guess what it is. like that praying grandmother, you know?
Yeah. They'll do it for you too.
Yeah. Now, I can remember when I first started out, moved to LA, I think I had $500 with me. And my aunt who raised me, I call her sometimes. She could tell by my voice, right? And then she called me back and said, go to Western Union, there's $100 for you. Those moments of absolute love. Now, $100 to somebody rich may not mean shit, but to and then I could like get on the subway instead of walk. Plus, that somebody cared about me, somebody loved me.
Absolutely.
Love you want to give to your audiences, no matter what medium you're in.
And sometimes that's enough too, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've already dropped a lot of words of wisdom, but if you could say one thing, you know, a piece of advice to young artists, especially young Black artists who are just beginning their journeys into the industry now in whatever field, whatever medium, what would you say to them?
Believe in yourself. Remember the first time that somebody made a Black dessert for you, whether it was banana pudding or some pound cake or, you know, apple pie or peach cobbler, whatever it was, made with simple ingredients, but made layered in the right way. And it was filled with taste and love. Just carry that with you into the world and be open to trying new things, you know? Mm. Food of the world, I'm a foodie, culinary food, you know? Mm-hmm. Chinese, Thai, Italian, French, but always keep that basic peach cobbler in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Gotta love the food analogies.
Yeah, you'll be all right.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. You can follow me on social media at Black Dirt Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get updates on new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Keep listening for special hints about the next episode. Until then, I'm Gabe Moses, and Black artists matter.
It's your grandchild.